Government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
And responsibility is one of the topics we're going to discuss heavily with Dr. Charles J. Camarda. He's worked for NASA for 46 years. He was working for NASA as an engineer, applied to the astronaut corps, was accepted, flew on STS-114, which was the mission after the Columbia disaster. And he's written a book about that, and about Challenger, and about NASA, and about organizations, and a lot of other things. It's fascinating. It goes into tremendous detail. For those of you that are information geeks, this is a fantastic book. It's called Mission Out of Control, An Astronaut's Odyssey to Fix High-Risk Organizations and Prevent Tragedy. And Dr. Camarda is with us on the phone, and he is, interestingly, we had an interview 2 months ago, but I only got to the first 80 pages of the book. I gave him my word I would finish the book, and last night, actually early this morning, I did finish the book, and I went to page 324. I read every word, and wow, you were right. I needed to finish the book. You were 100% right when you counseled me. So, you know, when you got somebody that actually knows something and they tell you something, if you're not stupid, you listen. I try very hard not to be stupid, and I usually succeed. So, what a wonderful odyssey into 46 years of working at NASA. That's an amazing work. How long did it take you to put all that together?
First, congratulations, Charles, for actually reading the book. It definitely isn't a page turner.
No.
You know, and so I was glad that you took the time to read it. And it was, you know, it took me a very long time to write it.
Okay. Are you?
And so, mm-hmm. So I guess I missed the question.
How long did it take you to write it?
Oh, it took me about 18 years. And there's probably a couple of different reasons for that. You know, at first it was very angry and at NASA. And so it took me a long time to actually dive in, to actually learn and research other areas of expertise, which I needed to understand. The real cause of the accident was the culture. And so I spent a lot of time reading books by Diane Vaughan, Amy Edmondson, Michael Roberto, hundreds of their papers, in order to really understand what they were saying. And because I was living it and I was experiencing it, but then words. And really, it wasn't until I, you know, after 18 years and I was finally finished writing it, as I was getting towards the end of it, that I realized that I saw something that they did not see, these experts. You know, we had lots of books by engineers, by people from Mission Operations Directorate at NASA, from journalists, and then you had people from the social sciences like sociologists, psychologists, organizational behavior. And what was missing was this understanding that I came to grips with, that I was a researcher. And what I realized was the research culture that I grew up with at NASA, at NASA Langley Research Center, before I became an astronaut, if we maintain that culture, all these other idiosyncratic explanations of behavior and causes of accidents all fall into place. You wouldn't have these problems if you were a good researcher and was trained and mentored by good researchers.
Well, there's a management culture in any in any large bureaucratic organization. There is a culture of, you know, where a lot of diseases like not invented here syndrome and we're in charge, we're the experts, and all those things happen to any bureaucratic culture that's, you know, to which NASA is no exception. Did they specialize in pioneering strange new worlds of bureaucracy to make a pun?
No, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct, Charles. All those same idiosyncratic behaviors that you see in large bureaucratic organizations did exist. The difference was that during Apollo, you had a very strong research culture. And so you had a balance of power. And so they could push back on these program managers that were trying to tell them to do something that they knew was wrong. And so after many, many years and during the shuttle program, you had this major imbalance of power at Johnson Space Center where people who were program managers, mission operators, they were operating these large complex systems, but they didn't have the technical expertise. Unfortunately, they had the money. They controlled the purse strings. And so engineers couldn't go off and do the experiments to prove them wrong, to prove there was a problem. And so they lost this power, if you will. And so there was this big shift in power and status. And so you had engineers that were afraid to speak up for fear of losing what little funding they would get.
Hmm. You know,
Charles, this is exactly what happened with Boeing, right? When you learned about the Boeing 737.
Right, the 737 MAX.
The 737 MAX, this was exactly one of the first things they said. It was the culture problem, and they tried to blame it on McDonnell Douglas management.
Yeah. Remind me about the MAX, the first break we take. I got to tell you something about the 737 MAX, but I will do it off the air. And, you know, it's like this, it's almost very Soviet, the way you describe NASA being run.
Yeah, and see, the reason why, you know, I didn't want to have to dig up all those terrible feelings that I did in the first half of the book, Charles, because it was almost like I have
you relive
PTSD.
Them. Right.
It's almost like I had PTSD. I would go to this terrible, dark place, but I had to bring it up because I really do not believe people, the public, will not understand how truly corrupt and dysfunctional this amazing organization that they hold high as this shining example, this castle on the hill, really was, how broken it really is.
Hmm. Have you seen the movie Hidden Figures?
Yes.
Does it, it's Hollywood, and it's a story, it's not real life, but does it somewhat follow the pattern of accurate depiction of NASA, or does it gussy it up?
You know, I don't know, of course, because I wasn't alive then.
Yeah, you weren't there, right.
But I did know Katherine Johnson. She was working at NASA Langley when I was there. And I believe it was fairly accurate. I'm sure there were, you know, this segregated facilities back then. And unfortunately, that was the way the country was. And but I do not know exactly whether or not her role and the importance of her role with John Glenn, how that actually was, and if it was accurately depicted. It seemed like it was, mm-hmm. but I can't speak from...
I get it. You weren't there, and it's not a fair question,
right.
but you're the only guy I know who works at NASA. Did you ever work with Chuck McClinton, the guy who developed the X-43? Because I know you did some hypersonic work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Chuck McClinton, and this is a very good story. I mean, he was one of those guys back when we were working on the National Aerospace Plane.
Uh-huh.
Chuck McClinton and a bunch of people at Langley were the leaders in hypersonics. And so when Reagan was ready to go with this hypersonic plane that could take off like an airplane, go to space, fly back, turn around.
Yeah, the SSTO, single stage to orbit.
Yes, single stage to orbit, a totally aircraft-like with a hybrid ramjet type engine. Well, amazing technology, but we were the leaders in hypersonics back in the 70s. And Chuck McClinton was one of those well-renowned aerothermodynamicists back then that was working on the aerospace plane.
Working on the what? Your phone fridged.
Right now.
Your phone fridged.
Excuse me?
Your phone fridged.
Working on the... Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah, it's intermittent. Move 5 feet.
Okay. I have it up to my ear, but I'll...
No, I mean, you move a couple feet. It's cutting out. The signal's cutting. Go ahead.
Okay. Move 5 feet.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then reach Miko.
I don't understand why that was happening, because I'm...
And then reach Miko.
Okay. But what was I going to say?
You were talking about Chuck McClinton and the hypersonics.
And so we were leading in hypersonics, if you remember, back in the 70s. And right now, we are behind the Russians and the Chinese in hypersonics. They have operational hypersonic weapons, and we're just trying to develop hypersonic weapons in the United States. So think about it. And we stopped funding because we stopped funding research at NASA right now. And we gutted the research we were doing in order to pay for the human space program. And the human space program right now is using 1970s technology, NASA's human space program.
You know, it makes you wonder why, of all people, the Chinese would be leading in hypersonics. They're not known for original research. They're known for ripping off other people's research and then building on it.
Right, and believe me, they and the Russians have ripped off our hypersonic research. As a matter of fact, the Buran was almost a knockoff of the space shuttle, right? Only they didn't quite get the thermal protection system technology quite right. So that was never going to be viable. Buran was never going to fly without major improvements in the technology.
Either that, or they could put pierogies on the sponsons and get them cooked real well, along with their astronauts. Funny, but not funny.
They definitely do pierogies pretty well.
Yeah, they do. But, well, you know, they're close.
Yeah, they're close. They're close. Pilmeni, I think they called them. They weren't like the Polish pierogies. Those are really good. But anyway, getting back to space, right?
Right.
Getting back to space, you know, right now we need to catch up. And so I hope that Jared Isaacman, when he steps up, realizes the difference between good engineering and research and why we need to get back to doing research. And it's not going to be easy, and we're not going to be able to do it quickly. We have to get back to where we were 30, 40 years ago and develop it.
What is a work group culture, and why is it a safety problem?
Well, a work group culture, it's not like a good high-performing team. A work group culture forms in order to solve a particular problem, and so they form and they think they understand the problem. Unfortunately, what happened with the work group culture during the Challenger and Columbia accidents, where you had these teams that were very isolated, and they really didn't pull in the real experts they needed to understand the problem. And so when we had the large foam impact that hit, they had a small group of people at Johnson Space Center that really didn't understand impact dynamics, really didn't understand impact of the wing leading edge, the reinforced carbon-carbon wing leading edge. But we had those experts at NASA research centers, but they did not reach out to them. They felt that they understood the problem. They started to work as an isolated, insular group of people, forming their own rules. And unfortunately, the way they developed knowledge and constructed knowledge and the way they constructed flight rationale had lots of mistakes, had lots of problems. And so that's what I talk about in my book, how these same people that missed the foam impact problem a problem that kids in high school would say there was no way we had the right analysis to predict that impact correctly. They totally missed when I discovered an anomaly in the wing leading edge on my vehicle after flight. I just happened to do it by accident. I read a paper that they had attached in an email with this one team, this one working group, and I realized that this was a major problem that they missed, and they tried to cover up, and they tried to say it wasn't a systemic problem. Insular, they don't allow disruptive people to challenge them, people to think critically. They all, it's almost like a groupthink mentality that they have.
Mm. And if you look in the dictionary under disruptive, you're one of the pictures.
Exactly. They got a picture of Charlie Kabat in the dictionary.
Yeah, right. Could there have been a rescue plan to bring the Columbia astronauts home on a second shuttle rather than have them burn up on reentry?
Yeah, I think the Columbia Accident Investigation Board looked at that. And if you look at one of the volumes or in one of the appendices to the Columbia Accident Investigation Reports, there were several volumes. They did look into that, and I think they said they could have had a plan if they could have readied a new space shuttle, got it on the pad within a certain number of days. They would have been able to go up there and possibly rescue the astronauts.
What about a Russian craft? You know what? We're over for a break, Charlie. Let's continue that. We'll be right back after this. I have got to. I get so fascinated by you that I lose all track of time. And boy, I'll tell you what, I'd make a lousy Capcom. I'd miss all the windows. All right, stand by in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, and we'll be right back after this with Dr. Charlie Camarda.
Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
Never give up on the power of the swap shop.
Who knows? And I mean, somebody could have had a whole bunch of old pagers laying around, and they called the swap shop and said, "Can we buy them? We got an order for some pagers. We just need to work on them a little bit first."
Swap shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch. We have the joy, pleasure, and honor of having with us Dr. Charlie Camarda. He is a NASA astronaut and a scientist. He's an engineer, and he has got a wonderful book called Mission Out of Control, and it goes into a lot of the details. Those of you out there, I know I have a bunch of Raytheon guys who listen to me, and there's other people who work in engineering at various things that we have in Tucson. The people who make some of the secret squirrel stuff for submarines are here at Johnson Controls, and for those of you engineer types, you're going to love the level of detail and also the diagrams in Mission Out of Control, an astronaut's odyssey to fix high-risk organizations and prevent tragedy. And what were we talking about? Do you remember what we were talking about right before we went to break, Charlie?
Oh, geez.
That's okay.
That's okay. We were talking about working group culture for
right.
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I've got 20 questions, so it's not a problem. did safety get better after Columbia?
No, safety got worse after Columbia. And people won't believe that, but we made some cosmetic fixes, is what I call it. What happened was, you know, the first two flights right after Columbia, we almost lost both flights, both missions, because of a piece of foam that almost hit our vehicles, just like Columbia. And and the people was using the same processes, the same procedures to determine flight rationale. They weren't based on real engineering data and research data. They were based on, some of it was based on probability risk assessment, they call it, which was found to be total garbage. And it was used incorrectly. It was really used to help provide a rationale for flight by saying things were probability of it happening. It was 1 in 10,000 that, for instance, the PAL ramp, the PAL ramp, wouldn't come off the vehicle and hit our vehicle, even though we asked them to take it off. They said there was only a 1 in 10,000 chance. Well, it came off and almost hit our left wing. And it got progressively worse because the person they put in charge of the safety organization was the person that was second in command during the shuttle program that didn't even understand that there was a major problem when that really large piece of foam hit the Columbia vehicle.
Hmm. You mentioned in your book that you once, related to that, you once asked the astronaut office to brief the astronauts on what they needed to do to make sure that they're able to, they were safe to fly and how to reach, you know, key researchers inside the agency and actually outside and around the country who had some technical expertise to answer anomalies that the astronauts experienced, and that you have never been allowed to give that closed door briefing to your astronaut colleagues. Why not?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Charles. You know, because I was a researcher for 22 years, and I worked on all these joint programs with the Air Force, with DARPA, with the Navy on these hypersonic vehicles like Space Shuttle. So I knew all these people all around the country. So, you know, when we flew in space, we didn't trust the people on the ground, and I had to rely on these experts that I knew to help solve this problem. And because I had this relationship, you know, I had all this knowledge. I wanted to explain to the other astronauts in the office how they needed to develop these networks in order to make sure that they would be safe. They have to rely on each other and who were the right people to talk to. And we're having the same problems right now with the heat shield on the Artemis vehicle.
You call them FOCs, Friends of Charlie. Basically, what you're talking about is developing communities of interest, networks, if you will, to ensure the safety of people. What is the purpose of insulating people against information as opposed to being free-flowing with it?
You're going to have to reach out to the new administrator of NASA when he's confirmed. And ask him that same question. You would think, why would a really high performing organization, a learning organization, not want to reach out to the best and the brightest? What happened was they developed what they thought were communities of practice, but as part of the NASA Engineering and Safety Center, it was run in a very hierarchical fashion by the same person that led the shuttle program during the Columbia accident, and they refused to go out and reach out to the people that might have dissenting opinions to them. And so they actually prevented me from getting information I needed to prove that there were major problems with the orbiter. And so they created a network that you would have thought would have been the right network, but the Friends of Charlie network is different because they're trusted. They know that they could speak freely. They're not afraid to speak. They differ with Charlie Kamada. But if they differed with Ralph Rowe, who was heading up the NASA Engineering and Safety Center, it might have been a different outcome. Okay? If they didn't give the message the boss wanted to hear, they would be in trouble. And so people were still afraid to speak up. The Friends of Charlie Network is a very trusted network of people, not only that have the expertise, that really have the right expertise that you need, but they're not afraid to tell Charlie Kamada he's wrong.
You might,
and I value that.
Yeah, you might even say that they had the, I don't know, right stuff.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, it's the way the astronauts used to be.
Right. Hang on, Charlie. We're up on our bottom of the hour break. We're going to take that now in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch. Swap shop trains coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Right? Bunker, 1960, directed by Otto Preminger, starred Paul Newman, Ingmar Marie Singh.
I knew if I shined the bunker light, it's like the rabbi light, only yours doesn't have the yarmulke.
Well, mine has a cowboy hat and a spur on it.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum, liberty, and in God we trust. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
And welcome back to this episode of Liberty Watch and also America Armed and Free. With the joy, pleasure, and honor of having with us Dr. Charlie Camarda, NASA astronaut for 7 years, and he was with NASA for 46 as an engineer, running the safety office for NASA at the Johnson Space Center, although he came to some loggerheads with management there about such topics, and then eventually he wasn't the manager of the safety office. But it's a fascinating discussion, and I've been playing music from both Star Wars and Star Trek. Today, of course, May the 4th. You know, it's a Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. Although, I know Charlie is not particularly into any aspect of science fiction, correct?
I'm not a big science fiction buff. I love watching it, but I'm not totally nerdy about it.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm going to go right back to it. Along the idea of ivory towers of information, contrast for us, if you would, the difference between the Toyota way, where anyone can stop the production line if something isn't right, with NASA's way of doing things.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, pulling the andon cord, as they call it, at Toyota, anyone, lowest man person on the totem pole, had the ability and the authority to pull that cord and stop it if they saw something wrong. And that's the way a good organization should work. Unfortunately, the safety culture at NASA got to the point where you had to prove that we were unsafe to fly instead of proving you were safe to fly. And the rules were stacked against you. It was a double standard. You had to prove there was a problem with much more technical rigor than you could, than the people that were trying to tell you we were safe to fly. Big difference.
Is that part of the failure is not an option culture?
You know, that failure is not an option. That culture, and of course it wasn't a real quote,
Kranz did not really say that.
It made for a great tagline in the movie. But I'll tell you, one of the things that was there within that mission operations directorate and also within the culture at Johnson Space Center was this arrogance. The supreme arrogance that they knew more than everyone else, and no one else could. They were the only ones that could send humans into space, other than the Russians at that time. And now, of course, you have the Chinese,
right,
and of course you have Elon Musk proving them totally wrong. Elon and Jeff Bezos.
You know, Charlie, the word arrogance sounds far more authoritative with a Brooklyn or Bronx accent.
It was. You know, at one time I thought that I could boil down all those different terms that the sociologists had talked about as causing accidents into just arrogance. Then I realized that another powerful term was this term psychological safety that a good friend of mine, Amy Edmondson, writes about in several books and hundreds of her papers. She developed the term. Really, psychological safety, creating that environment where people do not fear speaking up, taking interpersonal risk, and having their voices heard. And what you had and what you still have at NASA, and especially at Johnson Space Center, is this lack of psychological safety. People are still afraid to speak up.
Well, how do you create or stimulate a culture of psychological safety for pointing out things that are wrong?
Well, there were several ways that I was going to do it. You know, when Mike Griffin wanted me to be the director of engineering right after I flew in space, I knew it was going to be a tough job. I really didn't want the job, but he told me he was going to support me. And what I told every one of the people, 1,200 or so civil servants in the engineering directorate, was they had a direct line to me going around their chain of command if they saw something was wrong. If they were afraid to speak up, they could come to me. And I would carry the message forward. I would take the heat. That's what leaders do. I also told them that they were allowed to correct me if they heard me say something wrong, even if we were in an open forum with the public and there were hundreds of people there. I wanted to make sure that the worst thing they could do was not bring up a mistake or talk about a mistake. And so you model that by walking the talk as a leader, and you reward people that come to you with dissenting opinions and also with problems. You know, we had this culture. We had this culture that, you know, you have the production culture. The program managers want to keep flying on schedule and budget. And so when there's an anomaly and someone within their office comes and brings them a story with which they can develop flight rationale and continue flying, those people are rewarded. The people like Rodney Rocha that speak up and say, well, maybe we should take a picture, I don't think we should fly, those people are never rewarded. The only way you create this culture is by rewarding the behavior you want to see.
After the Columbia disaster, you suggested that, and NASA accepted the idea to develop an auto landing capacity so that an empty shuttle or maybe even a shuttle with incapacitated astronauts could come back to Earth and the crew rescued from the space station at a later time. You didn't think that NASA would accept that, but they actually did. Why didn't you think they'd like it, and why did they eventually do it?
Well, because I raised it to several of, like, the head of the astronaut office. These are all test pilots, you know, U.S. test pilots. They don't think that Autoland is a way we should be going. They don't trust Autoland, but I knew we had this capability. And, of course, now you're seeing it now. But what I really felt we needed it because was if you had that Autoland capability so you could decouple that decision, so that astronauts don't have to feel like we're going to end the space program if we destroy another space shuttle and want to jump back in there and fly it back and risk their life. They don't have to do that. We could still save the space program, save the shuttle, fly it back, and send up a new space shuttle to save the crew. And, of course, we had that. And so when we flew in space, we had some workarounds that the crew would have to do, a little bit of rewiring. And the team on the ground would have been able to undock the orbiter and fly it back.
That's fascinating. And, I mean, it's not unusual because today's airliners for probably 15 years have had autoland capability. And not all airports have it, but the major airline craft, like from 37 up, have got the ability to do that. It's not that bizarre a thing. You particularly said that, hang on, caller. You particularly said that the landing gear switch, for instance, had to be automated. Yeah. And things like that. But, I mean, this is not, to make a pun, this is not rocket science. The automation to do that isn't that complex.
And you know, I pushed back on one of the, I think it was Pam Melroy was one of the pilots that was telling me, no way, you can't do this. I said, Pam, the Russians landed the Buran autonomously.
Right.
You know, so give me a break. And the space shuttle was a lot more technically, competent than the Buran was back in those days.
Right.
Buran landed on its own.
Well, not only that, but with the Buran, they had to have a much wider variance factor for it, for the vodka consumed by the people running it. Anyway, your board structure diagram of the space shuttle program looks like it was created by Rube Goldberg.
Oh yeah. When you look at the reporting structure inside the space shuttle program, when I was director of engineering and I saw that, you know, all the different meetings and who was going to what meeting and what had to be presented, it was amazing that the right people were ever in the right room
at the right time. Yeah,
at the right time to make the decision.
We got a caller.
It was almost impossible.
Let me interrupt you. We got a caller. Caller, your first name, please.
Gary from Bisbee.
Gary, you're on the air with Dr. Camarda this time as well. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Camarda. With the advancement of space technology by Elon Musk, is he providing us a view of glaring errors on NASA? I know this is kind of a duh question, but is he giving us the look of why are they not seeing his advancements and following suit?
Sure. I'll tell you what the real advancements that Elon Musk is making and is showing the glaring difference almost by like about 100 years is the product development and how do you produce things economically fast, inexpensively. The technology, unfortunately, is that not that much more advanced. He's taking technology that we in the research community were working on probably in the 70s, and he's incrementally improved it, like the thermal protection systems. Look at the engines he's developing. He's developing, they're a lot more reliable, they're reusable. They're reusable engines. He's come up with a stainless steel tankage structure and structure instead of the aluminum. And so he's making incremental advances, but the real advances and the glaring difference between NASA is how he is building and going through the product development. NASA is using archaic models like waterfall and V diagrams for how to do engineering design. And that's like the legacy aerospace industry. And we have to take advantage of these newer concepts. What we were trying to get NASA to do is what we call set-based design, rapid concept development. And there are pockets of people that know how to do that at NASA, but not in the human spaceflight side, unfortunately.
Yeah, there are pockets of people, but unfortunately, they're the overalls people. You know, I think the technology that Elon Musk is taking advantage of is not so much 70s NASA, but Buck Rogers. Look at the way his spacecraft land. It's just right out of Buck Rogers.
You know, me and a good friend of mine now, Jess Bonneville in the Air Force, we used to fight like cats and dogs when he was in the Air Force. I was at NASA as to the right way that we should be landing these things. I was always going for the flyback boosters. Jess Bonneville at the Air Force was saying, no, we should be doing, he was working on the DCX back at that time. We should be doing vertical landing. I'd say, no, that's not the way to go. I had to call him up and apologize. After many years,
well,
that he was right.
Could it? This is Charles gets a stupid question once an hour. Could it actually mitigate the heat shield problem if you could slow down without generating as much heat? In other words, if you could lower the velocity in space so that it would drop. You know, you're dropping from orbital velocity to braking velocity much faster. So say that you enter the atmosphere, instead of hitting the outside of the atmosphere at 17,000, you hit the outside of the atmosphere at, say, 13,000 miles an hour. Would it necessarily mitigate the heat generation?
No, you're absolutely right. It's not a dumb question at all. If you could do that, if you had enough energy, but the problem is you would have to carry so much fuel.
Yeah.
I get it. What you're doing is, you're saving all that fuel by transferring it to heat.
Yeah, right. You'd turn a Prius into an 18-wheeler. I get it. That's a stupid. the concept's not wrong, but it's not workable in the modern way. Okay.
Right.
All right. Stand by. Gary, appreciate the call, and we'll be right back after this in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
Swap Shop trains are coming. Rolling down.
Sunday morning, 10 to 11 a.m. on KVOI, you can buy and sell and trade anything you want that's lawful and moral to own. Let's listen.
Rick, you're on the Swap Shop.
Hovercraft is like on Star Wars, but it's missing engine.
Yep.
Easy, Chewy.
It's got its own trailer. My number is 272.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
That, of course, the music from Deep Space Nine, but done by a lady with a violin who does all kinds of Star Trek and other theme music. Veridance, I believe it is. Veridance. And what's interesting is she dresses in the uniforms of the themes of the shows that she's playing, or in the costumes of it. She does the same with Game of Thrones. It's fascinating. If you like music and you like science fiction, you like space, it's fascinating. Viadance, I think, is what it's called. Anyway, back to Charlie Camarda and Dr. Charlie Camarda, NASA astronaut for 7 years and 46 years total with NASA. We have a very patient caller named George. George is on line two. George, your comment or question for Dr. Charlie Camarda.
Am I on the air?
You are, sir, on the air with us.
I'm Bob.
Bob, excuse me, Bob. Go ahead. My mistake.
That sounds like George. What the heck?
No, it's, you're right, I'm wrong. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. Hopefully I'm not going to mix up Charles and Charlie, but,
no, he's the smart
Charlie,
one.
I live in the same world that Charlie lives in, the safety world. And it's a pretty rough world. A lot of times, a lot of people, they're afraid to speak up, like he has already said. And I'm not sure if it went over your head or not, Charles, but, some of us are just brave enough to point out what's wrong and not be scared to point it out. And not to, you know, buck the authority where somebody thinks they're right. You can ask my medical doctors that. I have a hard time with them.
Well, you can ask the general manager of this company how well loved I am for doing just that.
Well,
go ahead.
Anyways, I live in the same world that Charlie does, whereas I make suggestions to my family members and I get barked at. But I'm not afraid to I'm not afraid to do it two or three times. And that, you know, eventually I may find another way to express myself, you know, but I won't stop trying to point out some type of unsafe activities that they're engaged in. I was a sailor and an airman in the Coast Guard. And there's a lot of safety involved with being a sailor. And, then there's a lot more involved when you start flying in aviation. You're flying in airplanes and helicopters. I mean, it's the difference between how long can I float on the water when you're a sailor and how slow can we make this airplane or helicopter go before we smash into the ground. You have a lot of lives at stake with a lot of the work that you do when you're in aviation. And with NASA, it's got to be incredible.
Or how long can I float on the water if I'm not a good aviator?
I flew on a seaplane. I flew on the Albatross. Most of the time we thought, well, we'll just land on the ocean if we have a power failure.
Not if it's more than 8 feet at chop.
Oh, even then they had some pretty heavy waves that they had to land in at times. And sometimes they would save people, then they would have to taxi back to the boat with the airplane being a ship instead of an airplane. Hmm. So it was a tough airplane. I tell you, it was the best. We called it a goat, and it was the greatest of all time.
I have been on board a number of Grumman Albatrosses with the air sea rescue people out of Traverse City, Michigan. They used to have every aviation day, they'd put them on display, and as a kid, I crawled through a whole bunch of those.
Oh, I love that airplane.
Yep, it's fun.
I'm sorry, I bleed too much patriotism and too much aviation and...
It's okay.
And I spent 10 years volunteering at the Air Museum, and the first place I wanted to go and I spent my time as was in the Space Museum.
Mm-mm.
And it was incredible to be in there. And then we had the Challenger Learning Center in there at that time, and
mm-hmm.
I had to check out the Rumble Room every morning. So I don't know about you, Charlie, but was our Rumble Room anything close to what it's like taking off in one of those spaceships?
It was, you know, I thought it was going to be a lot worse, but it was, it seemed a lot more quiet than what I would have imagined. I've only flown one time, but having the helmet on, the visor down, being inside the vehicle seemed a hell of a lot quieter than I remember watching it from 6 miles away. Mm-hmm. A launch.
Or maybe in a Saturn. I think that thing was tremendous. 7.5 million pounds of thrust.
I would really like to see a Starship launch. I still would love to see a Starship launch.
You know, I'm just betting that if you got to Elon's people and told them who you were, you'd get to be at a Starship launch.
I know some people that probably have a lot more pull than me, but I would love to get to meet Elon Musk. I was with him way back when he was first starting off, but I never did get to meet him personally. He was at a meeting out in California. It was an innovation meeting, and I think he just had his first successful launch of the Falcon.
Okay. Bob, I gotta get going. We're near the top of the hour, and I got a couple more for Charlie. Okay? Appreciate it. Thank you for your service to the country. All right. Have a great day. And that opens up a line for you after the top of the hour at 520-790-2040. How did your – we have just enough time before the top of the hour break. How did your friends at Charlie List avoid a potential disaster on STS-114?
Oh, yeah, you read about that, right?
Yeah,
that
I did.
Because we had a little piece of material sticking out from the belly of the vehicle at two places. It was called gap filler, a little Nomex-like, felt-like material that was very thin, was in between the shuttle tiles. It was just jutting out about an inch. And because we had just done a new maneuver, that where Eileen Collins commands a backflip underneath space station and the people on space station take photographic pictures with telephoto lenses and videos, they were able to see this anomaly. And it was because of a friend of Charlie at NASA Langley, a guy named Dr. Tom Horvath and Scott Berry at NASA Langley Research Center. They said this could be a problem. And I had to call him up at home because we didn't trust the people on the ground. And so I called him up on his cell phone at home and asked him if it was a problem. Did we need to do an emergency EVA? He sent up a report to us. He told us it was absolutely necessary. Eileen Collins believed me, listened to Tom, and that's what we called down. We said, we absolutely have to do this emergency EVA. And if we wouldn't have done that EVA, we would have probably been the next casualty, the next catastrophe.
Hmm. Which shuttle was that?
That was Discovery. We flew Discovery.
Discovery was actually the first shuttle, wasn't it?
I think Columbia was.
Oh, Columbia was. All right. 111. Oh, hang on a second. You want to turn the microphone on? Say it to the mic.
119.
Columbia was. And our mission was STS-114.
Right. We're up towards the top of the hour. I'm going to dispense with the top of the hour opening and just do station identification and then continue on with this interview because I don't want to break the flow. So this is AM 1030 KVOI, Cortero Tucson, The Voice, and stay tuned for America Armed and Free. Okay, America Armed and Free beginning. How did NASA respond how did repeated flights of the shuttle affect the heat shielding properties of the wings and the underside of the aircraft?
You know, what we found after Columbia, after we flew STS-114, was that in the highly heated regions of those wing leading edges, right at the intersection points between the different leading edge panels 8, 9, and 10, the most highly heated panels, underneath the coating, we were losing material. And so there were gaps underneath the coating of these wing leading edges, large gaps over long areas. And if a fleck of that coating would come off during entry, we would burn a hole in the wing leading edge and we would lose the vehicle. This was a systemic problem caused by the age over repeated use of these panels, because you can't see this by visual inspection. You have to use thermography. You have to use X-ray in order to see underneath the silicon carbide coating. And we knew there was a problem, And the people at the NASA Engineering and Safety Center were saying it wasn't a problem. The people that were in charge of the wing leading edge that said there wasn't a problem during Columbia said this wasn't a systemic problem. But what we found was that there were 12 of these panels in these highly heated regions that all had these defects. And we continued to fly 8 times, risking crews every one of those times, because the NESC wouldn't believe me that this was a systemic problem. They were actually telling people not to talk to me. They were preventing me from getting the data that to prove to them that this was a problem.
Are you familiar with the de Havilland Comet? What happened to it?
No, I'm not.
The de Havilland Comet was the first commercial jet. It was put out by the British de Havilland Company.
Oh.
And it was the first time that aircraft had flown high enough with pressurization that they had to deal with the expansion and contraction of the metals. And 2 de Havilland Comets crashed in the late 1950s, or maybe it was like 56 or something, where there were 2 de Havilland Comet crashes. And what the studies determined was it was the pressurization and depressurization cycles at altitude that allowed the airplane to expand farther than its design had allowed. And then what happened was when it depressurized, of course, to come back to Earth, the contraction was so great that it actually fatigued the metal, and the wings were falling off of it due to metal fatigue because of the expansion and contraction at the wing root joints where the expansion of the fuselage met with the wings. And that's what they figured out. And that's why airplanes today have a service life on them of just, you know, you can only have so many ascents and descents before they'll retire an airplane or turn it into cargo use or something like that. And that's why. And this, to me, although this is not an expansion and contraction problem, or maybe it is, it seems to me similar to the de Havilland crisis in the 1950s.
Well, the thing that's crazy about this, Charles, is that there were defects in 12 panels. We could have changed out those panels and continued to try to understand this and prove me wrong if I was wrong, right? But at least change the panels out before you fly, because we had spare panels. And they did not do that. They refused to do that. But talking about fatigue, let's fast forward to the Aloha Airlines accident, right?
Mm-hmm. Was that the one
where the roof came off the 737.
Right.
It was a major problem. It was a fatigue problem where cracks were growing because of the salt air and because of the number of cycles, because they were short flights in the Hawaiian Islands, remember?
Right, yeah, they went just up and down the short hops, and that has a tremendous amount of landing cycles.
Yeah, yeah.
And that poor stewardess got taken right out of they never found her body either. What a lonely way to die.
Yeah. Yeah, I know the people that were on that investigation, some of my mentors from Langley.
Hey, do you know Chesley Sullenberger?
No, but I would love to meet him. What an amazing man. What a humble man.
Just that one phrase, we'll be in the Hudson. You know, wow. It just said with total dispassion, you know, like, yeah, you know, I'm starting the
He's
APU. I'm starting the
He's
APU.
Hero.
He really is. Yeah. I'm starting the APU and we'll be in the Hudson, you know, it's the same level of emotion on both. Yeah. How do you get that steely? How do you develop a culture of research within any organization?
Within any organization, it takes leaders that understand what research is. And this is how it was introduced to me, a researcher as opposed to an engineer. A good engineer will tell you everything they know about a problem and what their analysis tells them about a problem that they're seeing. A research engineer will tell you what they don't know because they developed the analysis and they validated the analysis and they know all the assumptions that were made and they test to failure. So a researcher is that person that has this unquenchable thirst for knowledge. And if they see something that just doesn't look right, maybe it's that one data point that doesn't line up with all the others, that's the thing that drives that person crazy. And so not everyone is suitable to be a researcher. And so you go through this mentorship process and you determine which people are really good researchers and you mentor them and you create and you develop this culture. And they're there to understand how things fail. We had some amazing people at the research centers that if it wasn't for them, we would not have been able to understand the real causes of both Challenger and the Columbia accidents, and we wouldn't have been able to fix them. But back in those days, we let them form Tiger teams of these, led by these real researchers, not program managers and not flight directors, and they solved real problems. They drove to real root cause and came up with real solutions to problems.
How do you promote the communications part of that culture in any organization?
Well, it starts with leaders at the top and down through levels of management. And these leaders basically have your back. They are ready to protect you and develop this environment where it's okay for you to speak up. And they protect you. And so you're in this protective environment where that you know it's okay to make mistakes. You know it's okay to fail. But you have to learn something when you fail. And so we're taught how to fail. And so Amy Edmondson wrote two very good books. One, The Fearless Organization, which talks about psychological safety in organizations. The other one was The Right Kind of Wrong. There is a spectrum of failure from blameless failure to blameworthy failure. You know, the blameless failures, the failures we have in the, when we're testing the envelopes, we're trying to understand new phenomena is expected during the research and learning process using the scientific method. But when you go to the other end of the spectrum and we're preventing things and we see things that are wrong and we're allowing them to continue, that's blame. You have blame.
That's blameworthy.
That's blameworthy, exactly,
right, yeah.
in her words. And so you have to create this culture. And so the second half of the book, I kind of talk about, well, how do you change these dysfunctional cultures? And is there a time that we could use artificial intelligence and machine learning to help this process? And I think there is.
Well, what part should scientific curiosity play in that process?
Oh, scientific curiosity is at the top, right? Because it's all about knowledge. And so you're in a learning organization, you're creating new knowledge in a research culture, and you're trying to validate that knowledge. So that curiosity is first and foremost. You have to have it. You have to have that thirst.
Oh, it's interesting. Why was John Young your favorite among the astronauts?
Oh, he's the man. John Young, not only, I think, is one of the most courageous astronauts to fly the first space shuttle, but he wasn't afraid to speak up. He was not afraid to speak up. When he was the head of the astronaut office and we had the Challenger accidents, he basically spoke publicly about all the issues that NASA had, and he was fired for it. And I would fly to the Cape in the T-38 in the backseat with John Young, and he wasn't enamored by program managers and people high up in the organization. He flew in, landed at the shuttle landing facility. We went to the OPF, the orbiter processing facility. He spoke to the people on the ground that were the engineers working on space shuttle. And because those people trusted John Young, they would tell him everything that was wrong. They wouldn't tell their bosses what was wrong, but they would tell John Young. And John Young would go to the people at the research centers to solve these problems, not like the people at Johnson Space Center today.
Hmm. Sounds to me like somebody for, you know, a test pilot and a, you know, the fighter pilot bravado who didn't have his ego in the way of doing his job.
Oh, he had no ego.
Huh.
John Young was all about the safety of the astronauts.
Huh.
He was amazing. He spent hundreds and hundreds of hours, just like my other hero, Sullenberger, understanding that space shuttle. And if he saw any kind of anomaly that could happen, or there was a way of improving the safety of space shuttle, I remember he came to my office one day, and he said he was flying in the simulator, and they had this transatlantic abort, and for some reason it was a high energy TAL abort, and the only way to make it back to the landing field, he had to overheat the wing leading edges, and the wing leading edges burned up. Was there something we could do about it? And he came to me because he knew the first thing I ever worked on in my life was a heat pipe cooled wing leading edge, And I went to the people that I knew at Langley, and we came up with the design for a carbon-carbon heat pipe cooled wing leading edge that would have solved that problem. But see, that's the way John Young was thinking. In any high-risk, high-reliability organization, you're constantly thinking of how things could fail. It overcomes you. You're always thinking about failure. And so you look for potential ways things could fail, and you come up with solutions to the problems. That's John Young.
Got it. All right, we got a caller, Bruce, on the line. Bruce, you're on with Charlie Camarda, Dr. Charlie Camarda, of former NASA astronaut and engineer for 46 years. Your comment or question?
I have a comment and a question. First of all, I tell you, love the show. This is a great topic. Great hearing all of this information. John Young was, I think, the greatest of all the astronauts, and you're dead on with that. My question about maybe the second greatest pilot is, where would Dick Crippen fall in the category of great pilots?
Bob Crippen, of course, was on the first shuttle mission, and I didn't know Bob as personally as well as I did John, so I can't comment on it, and so I never flew in Bob's backseat, but I did fly with John Young, and he was absolutely a premier pilot. He was an amazing pilot.
And earlier there was a question or comment about the noise inside of the vehicle when you're lifting off. I interviewed Charlie Duke and also Jim McDivitt on my radio show, both of them great interviews, by the way, and by them, not so much by me as the host. But McDivitt talked about it in a different way because he flew both in Gemini and in Apollo. And he said on Gemini, you literally flew off the launch pad, and he said you never heard anything, and a little bit of vibration, and you just immediately went to speed almost. Charlie Duke said that the Saturn C5 and his Apollo vehicle, it was rumbling and You started out slow and got a little faster and got a little faster, but he said, when that thing got to speed, it was just an amazing vehicle. So just wanted to pass that along.
Great.
How appreciate it, Bruce.
And if I could, just real quickly, why is it, do you think, besides some of the actual engineering sort of techniques that SpaceX use, that maybe NASA is way behind, do they have that sort of a sense of freedom, the engineers and the researchers and management, to make advances quicker and all that, because there is that sort of open conversation, that open relationship between all those parties and more?
Well, I can't speak about the culture as far as it being open and how transparent and open it is. But I will tell you, he comes from the software engineering side of the house, where they tend to like to break things and fail and learn. And it's a lot easier to do. It might be a lot less expensive. What you're seeing, though, is a culture where failure is accepted. Right. They're actually cheering when they're watching their vehicle burn up. Right. When the Starship is burning up, you're watching these folks cheer, and that's great to a point, but you want to be able to fail probably small and less expensive. He can afford it right now, but we can't take these large failures. We need to understand what's happening in the laboratory, but what he's developing is a culture where failure is okay. They're not afraid to fail, but you do not want to fail when you have astronauts on the pointy end of the rocket. And so hopefully he understands that, and he's developing a culture where people are not afraid to speak up.
Great interview. Thanks very much. Thanks for your answers.
Appreciate it, Bruce. And that opens the line for you in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, which, ironically, Wilkinson is here. And so we'll be back after this. We have our first break of the hour coming up. Charlie has graciously agreed to share his time with us for 2 whole hours, and we're going to take full advantage of that in terms of asking him everything I can think of based on his book. And we'll be back after this.
This is Herman Cain.
And if it has a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade, you'll find your topic on America Armed and Free. Sundays, right after Liberty Watch.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Don Wells, is there anything you missed on the island?
Oh, well, actually, what I really missed, there we were with nothing to do. What I missed most was the Swap Shop. I mean, what fun we'd have had. I don't know how we'd have gotten a hold of you, but we'd have tried.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Hi, Mark Levin here. America Armed and Free. Sounds like a good title for a book. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Imagine that this is your daughter.
What do you want?
Now you get to decide how this scene ends. Or...
Stop, Earl!
Some misinformed people want to take away your daughter's choice between rape and self-defense. We're pro-choice on self-defense. Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. JPFO.org.
And may the 4th be with you. It's Star Wars Day, and Star Wars and Star Trek music featured for talking about NASA in the first quarter of the second hour is already gone. I have an insane curiosity that goes along with this program about things that fly, shoot, and cut stuff with a muzzle, a nozzle, or a blade. Do most people on the shuttle carry a pocket knife?
Oh, wow. You know, I'm trying to think if I carry one. I think I did. I know Don Pettit definitely had some sort of a Leatherman or some advanced pocket device. I guarantee you my good buddy Don Pettit had something. I think I did carry a pocket knife.
Tim made it to space. I love it. Tim Leatherman. I was wondering about, you know, the ubiquitous Swiss Army knife. I carry both the Swiss Army knife and another multi-tool. Mine is from SOG, not Leatherman. I used to carry Leatherman, but I want you to write this down, Charlie. The SOG.
Oh, wait a minute.
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
SOG, S-O-G.
Mm-hmm.
Stands for Special Operations Group, which is what it's named after. SOG,
okay.
Power Pint, one word. Power, P-O-W-E-R, P-I-N-T, Power Pint.
Uh-huh.
I want you to look it up, and I think you should buy one and own one, and if you feel like it, carry it with you everywhere you go. You will find you don't realize how you live without it, but here's a caveat. You got to use it on a pocket clip. Because if you leave it loose in your pocket, it'll open and you'll harpoon yourself on it. That's what Mike Mike Emery, the mechanic, found out. He goes, "Oh, you got rid of that thing and gave it to me." And he goes, "No, I didn't get rid of it. I gave you my favorite tool and went and bought another one." But he doesn't want anything clipped to his pocket because he doesn't want to scrape a car with it. And I get it. But if you can't carry it loose in your pocket.
And don't carry it on a commercial airliner.
If you do, take the blades out of it first. There are TSA compliant tools. There's also another one called the GOAT tool, G-O-A-T tool. And the GOAT tool has user swappable blades. You can take all the sharps out of it and make the thing TSA compliant and carry it on the plane if you want to.
Okay.
It's just, I don't know, you probably still fly a lot, don't you?
Yes.
Yeah, I quit that. I have developed a distaste for TSA, and I refuse to do business with them. I just don't fly anymore. Oh.
Interesting.
Your mileage may vary. And I'm also not going to bother with that real ID crap. You probably have government ID, though, because you probably still do some consulting work for them, so you probably don't have that problem. Anyway, I digress.
No, actually, I don't do. I don't have government ID. I lost my top secret clearance. And I'm happy. You know, I wish I still had my top secret clearance, because I have been at a couple of hypersonics conferences. I see the good stuff, but I can't see the good stuff.
Yeah. Is that just an expired, or you got politically out of favor?
No, it expired, and I wasn't working for any company that would maintain
sponsor.
It. You know, right. So,
Today's culture of the handheld device has spawned an awful lot of, shall we say, narcissistic behavior. How do you ride that out of a culture in an organization?
The handheld device.
You mean cell phones.
That's a tough one. That's a tough one because, you know, one of my other passions, as you probably know, Charles, is education.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worry about that. I worry about that with my grandkids. Are we teaching these kids how to do due diligence when they're researching what they're learning, and are they learning and what they're reading and what they're interacting with? Is it valid? Is it correct? You know, and I think that's one of the best things we could teach our kids is knowledge literacy should be a subject in elementary school and also in high school. And how do you source the information? How do you make sure it's well vetted and it's proper before you consume it, you know?
It seems to me like that's almost an operating system, not programming. It seems to me, I mean, I'll give you an example personally. When I was growing up, I would ask my parents, I would just yell out from my room, hey, how do you spell, you know, whatever word, narcissist, or whatever the word was. And you would hear in stereo from both ends of the apartment in Chicago on Hoyne Avenue, look it up, from my mom and my dad at opposite corners of the apartment. And it got to be a mantra, and it got to be into it. It stepped into the core programming that I had to look it up. And I would say, well, how do I look it up if I don't know how to spell it? And the next thing you'd hear from both ends of the apartment was, sound it out. And, and it taught me to look things up. And that urge has, even while during our interview, when you're talking about various astronauts and Jim McDivitt and looking up all these people to see if they're still with us, and just this culture of looking it up seems to me like there's more of a, that it's more, like I say, of an operating system than a programming. How do we install that operating system in our kids?
Well, it's so easy to look it up now. It's kind of ridiculous, but there's good and bad. You know, where there's so much really good information, good knowledge that kids could learn all on their own. The democratization of learning is such that you can go to the Khan Academy, and the Khan Academy even has artificial intelligence now to help guide the students on this learning journey. And that's going to be the future, making sure we have this really good content that's well curated and easily accessible for kids all around the planet. I mean, that's the gift that we can give humanity, is that everyone has the same access to really great learning and knowledge.
You know, you got to be careful which AI bot you select at Khan Academy, otherwise you incur the wrath of Khan.
You're very punny.
Yeah, I couldn't resist. You know, sometimes, like I said, I know you're not a Star Trek nerd and all that, but I just sometimes. Are there guys at NASA that would engage in Star Trek and type conversations, or did that stuff not occur in the building?
Oh no! What are you kidding? We had, you know, one of our astronauts, Mario Runco from New Jersey, looked almost like Leonard Nimoy. I mean, it was an identical clone. I think they've even have him in Star Trek outfits with Leonard Nimoy. And so, yeah, it was very big.
Huh. Sounds like infinite beauty and infinite diversity. Anyway.
I know you're looking up Mario's picture right now.
What was his name? Mario what?
Mario Runco, R-U-N-C-O.
Mario Runco.
Nice Italian boy from New Jersey.
M-A-R-I-R-U-N-C-O.
U-N-C-O.
Mario Runco. MIT offers all its courses online. Oh, that's interesting. MIT offers all of its courses online free of charge.
That's right.
I did not know that.
That's right.
Oh, my word. Mario MIT, Runco. Yes. Mario Runco. They even have him in, oh, yeah. He was an astronaut.
Yes, he's an astronaut. Yeah.
Oh, and he does look a lot like Nimoy. I wouldn't say he's a dead ringer, but if you put ears on him, he could play the younger version of Cybok, Spock's half brother. So yeah, astronaut Mario Runco Jr. Did he talk to Nimoy?
He did. He even got to meet Leonard Nimoy, and I'm sure if you'll go online, you'll see some pictures of him dressed up and possibly with Leonard Nimoy.
I can't really surf while I'm on the air. That's beyond that's one bridge too far. I'm running the board as well as hosting the show, and it's just one bridge too far.
You could do it.
Yeah, later I will do that. And you know what would be interesting? What does he do now? I assume he's retired from NASA.
He is retired. I don't know if he's retired totally. I haven't kept in touch with him. Last time I saw him, we were going to see the first Artemis launch that was scrubbed, and I haven't spoken to him since. So that was 4 or 5 years ago.
Uh-huh. You know what I would love if you would do? Hang on a second. Caller, I'll be right with you. You know what I would love? If you would email him, back-channel him, and give him my info and tell him I'd love to have him on. Because this, to me, I call this doing production on the hoof, you know, doing radio producing while you're live on the air. But this is how you find great leads, is you find people who know people and share a common interest, and within that community of interest, book interviews out of it. I think it's a fun way to find somebody. We got a caller. I'm going to take him in the blind. Caller, your first name, please.
My name is Mike.
Mike, you're on the air with Dr. Charlie Camarda. Your comment or question for him?
Well, first and foremost, I think this is just a fascinating subject, and I absolutely love the fact that you have him back, because then, you know, you finished the book, you now have so much more education about the process, what I call the NASA complex. And, you know, Charles, when I was a kid growing up, and I will follow up with a question. Well, when I was a kid growing up, the space industry and everything about the space experience as a child was absolutely fascinating. And I loved the NASA, what's the word for it?
Ethos? Culture?
Thank you. So much, in fact, that, as you know, in the front of my business, I have a little NASA sticker. It's right on my front window. And the reason why it's there is because of the invention and the absolute fascination that I had with guys that were actually willing to risk their lives and go into space. And I thought, if those guys are willing to do that just for exploration, can you imagine what Columbus went through and all these people? It's just a fascinating facet of Americana. And you commented to me once. You said, why would you put that NASA sticker on your window? Do you remember asking you that?
No.
Well, I remember you asking it, and I remember telling you that I thought it was the most fascinating part of government, and you kind of cringed, because I get it. A big part of government was NASA, or is NASA, and that's why I think it's so fascinating that this doctor, who has written this book, has so much experience in this realm, and it's just a fantastic subject. So thank you very much for putting him on.
Do me a favor, when the program ends, go online and buy it. It is called, once again, Mission Out of Control. Let's see, let me find the exact subtitle. Mission Out of Control, An Astronaut's Odyssey to Fix High-Risk Organizations and Prevent Charity. They're not a lot, but a little of what he wrote might apply to the hierarchy of any business, even yours.
Yes.
You don't have the problems in your business that NASA has. You don't have anywhere near the hierarchy.
I get that.
But that
was the reason for my call, because I do have a question for your guest.
Go ahead.
Can I make a statement?
Please do.
For Mike said, and Mike, what I want you to understand is I love NASA. The first half of my book sounds like I'm down on NASA, and maybe seeing some of my local tweets and my – social media sounds like, no, we need to make NASA great again. And this is, I think, our one last chance to do it. And I believe Rook Isaacman, Jared Isaacman, when he's confirmed, if he listens to the right people, we have an opportunity to do it. I stayed at NASA for 13 years after I was reassigned, and I wrote the second half of my book really because I think we could fix these organizations that are in trouble, like NASA and like Boeing. Go ahead with your question.
Mike, can you remember your second question for a minute? I'm a minute and 30 late on a break, and I've got these really pesky sponsors who insist on their ads being played. Can you hold on for a little bit?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I enjoy my own commercials, sir.
Okay. He's one of the two anchor sponsors on the program. Hold on.
Welcome to Monoral Radio, where we sing in black and white.
I think that is musically the prettiest of all the Star Trek themes. It is the one for Voyager. That's done with by Via Dance, that gal with the violin. Charlie, did you listen to any music in space?
I did. You know, we all get to pick. Our music to wake us up.
Yeah, your wake up song. Yeah,
wake up music. I also carried a young lady that grew up in my neighborhood, famous Broadway actress,
mm-hmm.
Bernadette Peters.
Right.
I brought up one of her albums, her CDs, from which was a tribute to Sondheim.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
I would listen to that right before when I was relaxing, getting ready to hit the sack.
Does the CD ever skip in weightlessness?
No, it worked beautifully.
It works beautifully. Okay.
Sure they have much better technology now.
Yeah, now you got an MP3 player. All right, caller, your first name, please.
My name is Mike.
Mike, again, go ahead.
First of all, Charles, it's called oversampling. And the reason why it doesn't skip is because it's already been read 26,000 times before you get to hear it on a CD, by the way.
It's a good thing it doesn't reach escape velocity.
Exactly. So my question to the gentleman on the phone,
Dr. Camarda,
is yes,
Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. You know what? It must be the neatest thing to be able to tell people. And I mean, I've been very fortunate. I've been able to fly airplanes and do all kinds of neat stuff. But one of the things in my pedigree is not space. And I got to tell you something. That must be the neatest thing to be able to tell somebody. I was on a space shuttle, or I walked on the moon, or just something like that, that you actually had the ability. So my question, and although it's double-barreled, if you were the head of NASA and you had all the resources of the United States government at your fingertips, like you guys had back in the 60s and the 70s and even the 90s, what would you have done differently to make NASA perfect? Like, I think it could be the entity of a lifetime.
Yeah. Well, I talk about this in my book, Mike, and I would say we need to get back to being a research culture. You remember when it was NACA, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics,
it was instituted right after
World War One, and it was the intent was to make NASA's aircraft industry the best in the world. We didn't have any planes flying in World War One. Even though we had the Wright brothers, that technology was basically all the planes were German, French,
yeah. And, the Blériot and the Newport.
So what we had was these small, very, very new research centers at Glenn, at Lewis, at Langley, and at Ames in California that were doing the far-term research to understand the physics of flight in the atmosphere. And we transferred that knowledge with partnerships with our aircraft industry, commercial industry, to make them the best in the world. I think NASA needs to go back to that. What happened was we started siphoning off all those research dollars that we were doing in aeronautics and also in space technology and hypersonic flight, and we were putting it into human space flight. And so now what you do is you see us operating space systems. And NASA and the government should not be doing that. You don't see government operating airlines, right? And so if you draw the analogy between the aircraft industry and the space industry, I think Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and others are proving that industry could do flying humans into space. I think NASA needs to get back to doing research into the far term, the next generation ion thrusters and things like that, advanced thrusters, advanced materials, advanced thermal protection systems, in order to make space flight as safe as we made aircraft flight.
Hmm. So here's the double part of my double-barreled shotgun question. If the United States government gets its fingertips out of NASA and NASA was to go private, just like Musk, it would be phenomenal, because then they don't have the strings attached. They don't have all the government BS and bureaucracy crap and the EPA and all the other stuff that these government entities have to deal with. And that would that would completely change the industry. Do you not agree?
I don't agree completely. I think we could learn from industry to do things more efficiently. The way NASA used to do things. NASA during the early Apollo days was much like SpaceX is right now. The problem with what you're saying, Mike, is that all these companies, these private companies, eventually they get driven to the bottom line and the near-term profit.
Called money, of course.
For their investors. And so the only way we're going to be insured to stay ahead is we have to do that far-term research. And so if we go back to the way the government used to do it, looking at the things that are way out there in the future, and we're trying to develop them, just like composite, let's take composite structures, for instance. The, the NASA and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base did premier research in composite structures development to the point where we understood the behavior of that material so that we can now transfer it into making very lightweight, efficient structures for aircraft.
Well,
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Did they not invent carbon fiber?
I'm not sure who invented carbon fiber, but
I know that NASA was implementation. Yeah. Of carbon fiber and plastics.
But implementation, but not necessarily the invention thereof.
Well, Charles, one thing you have to remember, in the aspects of government or in the private sector, there are guys working for these corporations that are applying for patents constantly.
These
patents are what is part of that industry. And if a guy comes up with a composite, I promise you that NASA, in fact, wasn't it, you know, my favorite commercial of all time was the Tang commercial. You might remember it.
I do.
And that was all about NASA. All of the how many thousands of experiments and items have been produced thanks to the space program?
Huh. Yeah,
you're absolutely correct, Mike. And back then, NASA valued its patents. It's very difficult to get a patent now, but there were thousands of patents in polymer chemists that were coming up with advanced composite materials, reinforced carbon materials. And that was amazing. NASA has stopped, has made patenting very difficult.
Why?
You're talking to the wrong person. I don't understand why they did that, but it's very difficult. It made it difficult for engineers to patent what they want to patent.
Because it's not part of the corporate culture.
I just don't understand that,
Charles.
But the very innovative companies like the Corning Glass, they have a
Pyrex was invented by NASA.
Something very precious. And they love to protect that intellectual property. And thank God, maybe this president will do that. You know, because we're tired of being undercut by the Chinese stealing our inventions, right?
For what it's worth, in 1860, Joseph Swan produced the first carbon fibers for use in light bulbs. In 1879, Thomas Edison baked cotton threads on bamboo slivers at high temperatures, carbonizing them into carbon fiber elements. In 1880,
I said that's wonderful, but NASA still has a patent.
No, it doesn't.
Fiber. Look it up.
No, it doesn't. In 1880, Louis Latimer developed a reliable carbon wire filament, and in 1958, Roger Bacon created the first high-performance carbon fibers at Union Carbide, Panama Technical Center, located outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and he had the first patent on it.
What was it called, Charles?
Carbon fiber.
It was not. It was called polymer.
No, it was...
NASA invented polymer, which is a part of a carbon fiber composite.
Okay.
Now, we can talk about this all night.
Yeah, we'll talk about it later when Charlie's done.
I don't care.
Yeah.
What I want to ask Charlie, in closing, is from an engineering standpoint, and believe me, I have a lot of that in the background, I want to know, what is it like from the velocity standpoint of being on the ground and going into space? What does it feel like?
Well, it's like a slow freight train building up speed slowly, and you're feeling the pressure of the acceleration on your body very gradually building up to about 3 G's, and it feels like you have the pressure like an adult is basically sitting on your chest as you're climbing into space for those 8 minutes.
So once you get into the belt, okay, once you get there, does the gravity pull change or is it minimal?
Well, you never lose gravity. What happens is you're falling around the Earth, right? And so you're in a constant free fall around the Earth, around the globe.
But your body's reacting to the pressure of the pull of the Earth's gravity field, right? I mean, so when you're in weightlessness, you're floating around because there is absolutely no gravity. There's no magnetic pull, or I guess the weight pull. Okay, when do you notice it? Is there a particular point in the belt that you're either going through the belt, you get past it, then you're into zero gravity?
It's not a belt, Mike. It's almost like you're getting shot out of a cannon from a mountain, and you're going fast enough, you reach escape velocity, so that as you're falling towards the Earth, you're missing the Earth. If you could imagine that, you still have the pull of gravity trying to bring you back to Earth, but you're in a constant free fall. It's like you're in a constant free fall with the vehicle going around the Earth.
Which one is worse, going up or coming down?
You know, I didn't really notice a big difference. Some people it affects differently. You get what they call space awareness sickness, and you get kind of disoriented going up and when you're actually on orbit. And some feel it when they come back. You know, if you've been in zero gravity or microgravity for very long periods of time, like my good friend Don Pettit, when they pulled him out of the Soyuz capsule, he looked like a wet noodle. Because of demineralization of your bones, losing that bone density, your muscles atrophy, even though you are working out. Don talked about all the little muscles that you don't realize. You know, the big muscles you might work out in space, but you have all these ancillary little muscles that affect you when you come back. And so it's a much bigger deal if you've been there for a long period of time.
Charles, may I ask you one last question?
We're three minutes over for a break, but go ahead.
Okay, I apologize.
Just ask.
This is the most fascinating conversation. Okay, so when you're going down 80 feet in a dive, as you're coming up, you have to substantiate your buoyancy, and as you know, you'll get the DTs if you do or Charles, is it the DTs?
No, the DTs have to do with alcohol. The Bens have to do with nitrogen.
Okay, yeah, nitrogen. Yeah. Okay, well, you know what I mean. Lo siento mucho, they say in Yiddish. Anyway, all I want to know is when you're going through space, it would seem to me that you would have the same type of issue because your body is trying to adapt to the changes.
But in the other direction. In other words, that's a great question, Mike. I'm going to let you go at this point. Charlie, do you have to adapt to pressure when you get back to, you know, to, oh, I guess in the shuttle, you're more or less at what, 5 PSI or 6, 7 PSI? What do they pressurize the shuttle to?
I think it's almost, it's very close to ambient.
Oh, really? So it's 14.7 in the shuttle.
Yeah. Now, when you do an EVA,
right,
you know,
yeah,
you have a higher, much higher oxygen content because you're trying to get all the nitrogen out of your system.
Right.
And so when you do EVAs, you do have to worry about things like the bends and things mm-hmm. like that, but not when you're just flying in the shuttle or living on the space station.
How long do you have to pre-breathe pure O2 before you do an EVA?
You know, it depends. They have different protocols. And they were looking at exercise. They were looking at an exercise protocol to reduce the amount of time. Sometimes they spend the night in the airlock to basically scrub their bodies of the nitrogen.
Of nitrogen, yes. Yeah, so that when you repressurize, it doesn't give you a rapid case of the bends because there ain't no decompression chamber they can put you in up there. All right, stand by. We'll be right back after this. In the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, last chance to call Dr. Carmada at 520-790-2040 about his book, Mission Out of Control. It's fascinating.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
This is Caroline.
Happy chickens.
We have a 5-acre horse property for sale.
They're participating in the program.
Please make that part of the package.
A ranch with chickens. They might call that the chicken ranch.
I've been called worse.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m. right before Liberty Watch.
That's why a lot of radio people get hard of hearing is they're wearing headphones and they turn the music way up. And but it brings something with Dr. Charlie Carmada, astronaut and author of the book Mission Out of Control. The subtitle on that is An Astronaut's Odyssey to Fix High-Risk Organizations and Prevent Tragedy. It's a pretty technical book. It's got some great diagrams in it and what some of the stuff is that goes wrong and how we can fix some of this. He's got the whole Chapter 8 is how do we fix this. And I probably should have laid heavier on that during this interview, but, you know, you can't stay serious forever, and that's where I want to go. That music about the alien scene in the bar scene in Star Wars, there has got to be. I mean, do you guys ever, at NASA, did you guys ever, like, do any dress-up or, you know, Halloween, everybody dresses a Star Wars character or Star Trek character? And so what are some of the funny things about NASA, the inside of NASA? You recommended on the break a YouTube channel.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have some amazing astronauts that are really funny. A good buddy of mine, Mike Massimino and Garrett Reisman, they have a podcast. So they used to have a podcast called Two Funny Astronauts. I was in two episodes. We have some amazing stories, and we do have a lot of astronauts that are just amazing senses of humor that we have. And you talk about dressing up. You know what the astronauts do, the new astronaut class, every Christmas they have a Christmas party, and the new astronaut class has to provide the skits, the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And And so, and you really see, I mean, Butch Wilmore, is hysterical, did a funny routine. Many of the astronauts come up with funny routines. One of the things that me, Mike Massimino, a couple of the other astronauts that were in the same class at that time, we did a skit that was like a Saturday Night Live skit. It was the New York crew. And so if you can imagine, instead of an all-female crew, but you had all New Yorkers, and they're with their little Italian T-shirts, and they're shooting craps in the on the deck of the space shuttle, and we're doing all these tremendous skits that were right out of Saturday Night Live. We had a lot of fun. We did have a lot of fun.
What is the if there's a story that's radioable? What is the funniest thing that you ever saw, either on the ground at NASA or in flight?
Oh, funniest thing I ever saw. I would say when we were filming one of those skits, for instance, you can imagine we're newly hired astronauts trying to get through training, and me and Mike and a bunch of the other crew were basically doing a skit for the New York crew, and we're in one of the simulators in Building 9, and we're in there with our flight suits half down with our T-shirts showing, and we're throwing dice, and John Young comes into the window of the hatch and knocks on it, and we were just terrified. We thought we were going to get into trouble, and John Young goes, "What are you guys doing in there?" And we said, "Oh, Captain Young, we're doing a skit for, you know, for the Christmas party." He says, "Well, it looks like you guys are the only guys working." And we were like so relieved, but we thought we were going to get into such trouble. And John Young just had this unbelievable sense of humor, and he was a great guy. I miss him.
Do people make fun of the danger that's involved in flying in space?
Do we laugh about it as astronauts?
Yeah, well, let me tell you why. Have you ever read Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land?
No, I never have.
There's this scene where he goes to the zoo. He's trying to learn how to be a human. And he goes to the zoo and he sees a bigger monkey beat up on the next smaller monkey until the last one, the fourth one in a row, gets pummeled pretty badly. And he laughs. And he says, "Why is that?" And his friend says, "Why are you laughing?" He goes, "I grok. I understand that laughter is a bravery against all things cruel and rotten." And that's why I asked. We're down to the last 15 seconds.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, but that's something I rely on a lot of times. I guess when I'm in dangerous situations, I guess I laugh about some things. I know launching into space, being on the mid deck, I didn't have any other job to do. I was just laughing almost the entire 8 minutes going into space.
Okay, give your website, Dr. Camarda.
My website is missionoutofcontrolbook.com or charliecamarda.com.
Missionoutofcontrol.com, book.com, or charliecamarda.com. All right.
Missionoutofcontrolbook.com.
Okay. Yeah. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Have fun.
If you hang on, I'll talk to you off the air for just a moment. All right. I want to encourage everyone to be vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative. In liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson.